Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Between No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, Republican and Democratic presidents each have had their own education catchphrases. Today, the states weighed in. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 436 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 10th of March, and it is good, as always, to have you with us. It's not quite a complete overhaul of the time-honored traditions of reading, writing, and arithmetic, but the proposal out today on new academic standards could prove to be a very big deal. A panel set up by state governors and education officials lays out year by year what public school students ought to learn in math and English to better prepare them for college and, eventually, for working. There is a big sweetener to get states to sign on to the new standards. That's a notoriously difficult prospect, by the way. Those states will get a chance at a share of $4 billion from the Obama administration's Race to the Top. But the publishing industry might come out the biggest winner. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott reports.
Anytime states adopt new education standards, companies that publish textbooks and tests cash in.
It certainly will lead to new business. Whether it will be a bonanza, I don't think anybody knows at this point.
Jay Diske is executive director of the Association of American Publishers School Division. He says after a big push to rewrite curricula in the 1990s, some publishers saw double-digit sales increases. Standardization could also save publishers money. Diske says having to customize materials to meet a patchwork of state standards has driven up costs. But analyst Kathy Mickey says while all but two states have signed on to help develop the new standards, she expects far fewer to adopt.
The key thing, I think, for the industry will actually be how many in which states implement the Common Core standards.
Texas has already implied it will not. Mickey says the state is a big player in the textbook industry. She says its standards often dictate what ends up in other states' books. If Texas opts out of the common standards, Mickey says the state's influence might change.
A significant number of other states have adopted common standards that make it much more attractive for publishers to build a textbook around those common standards. But they're certainly not going to ignore selling to Texas.
Analysts say standardization may ultimately hurt the testing industry. If states adopt a national set of tests, some publishers could lose out. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
18 months on from the collapse of Lehman Brothers, we are still waiting for Congress to get around to writing new rules for the financial sector. Well, we're waiting for half of Congress anyway. The House passed its financial reform bill back in December. The Senate, not quite yet. Its version has been delayed for months as senators haggle over what may or may not be in the final bill. We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale to help explain what might get left out.
Leaks from backroom negotiations indicate senators are trying to exempt parts of the financial industry from strict federal regulations. Auto lenders, mortgage originators, smaller banks, and credit unions, for example. The New York Times reports Tennessee Republican Bob Corker wants to exempt payday lenders from the new rules. Lawmakers call those carve-outs, and at a panel discussion today, Senator Corker denied he's pushing any.
There is no carve-out for payday lenders, so there's no carve-outs for anybody.
Still, reports persist the Senate bill may shield banks from some state oversight, keeping states from imposing stricter rules on the financial services industry. Tim Duncan, with American Business Leaders for Financial Reform, says powerful interest groups are at work.
You know, let's be honest, this isn't about the substance, it's about political contributions and lobbyists getting their customers exempted.
The lawmakers behind efforts to water down the bill are rarely revealed. On MSNBC today, the House version sponsor, Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank, said opponents of tough regulations will have to back off once the House and Senate try to reconcile their differences.
I think some of my Republican colleagues who are prepared to kind of cut back on consumer protection and sensible regulation in private deals may be less willing to insist on that if we've got to do it publicly and vote on it publicly.
The lead Senate negotiator, Connecticut Democrat Christopher Dodd, expects a final proposal in a few days. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The agribusiness giant Monsanto is going to be a big topic in Ankeny, Iowa this Friday. The Justice and Agriculture Departments will be holding what's billed as a workshop on agricultural antitrust. Interestingly, Monsanto and antitrust are increasingly being mentioned in the same sentence. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
According to Bloomberg News, at least seven state attorneys general are joining forces to investigate possible antitrust violations by Monsanto. On top of that, the Justice Department has been investigating the company's marketing practices. Today, Monsanto execs kept mum, but a corporate spokeswoman speed-read a statement.
Monsanto believes an objective review of the agricultural sector will reveal that competition is alive and flourishing.
That was, competition is alive and flourishing, an assertion many U.S. soybean and corn farmers dispute. John Crabtree directs the Center for Rural Affairs in Nebraska. He says when farmers pay for seed these days, it doesn't feel like there's competition.
When not too many years ago, they used to be able to buy a bag of soybean seed, for example, or corn seed for under $100 a bag, and now they're paying close to or even above $300 a bag. These are enormous price increases.
Well, Monsanto has been increasing prices for their seed.
Iowa State University economist Bruce Babcock.
And the reason they've been able to do it is because they produce really good seeds and they have property rights over those seeds.
Antitrust lawyers say it's not illegal for a company to hold a monopoly share, but Babcock and others say the real question is whether Monsanto uses its market power illegally to stifle competition. Among the practices that may violate the law, offering generous rebates to seed distributors if they exclude rival products. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We mentioned yesterday that it was the one-year anniversary of the Great Recession's stock market lows. So far, I pointed out. We're going to go farther back today, March 10th of the year 2000, when the NASDAQ closed at its all-time record high. Also, so far, I guess I should say, it could always go up from there. 5,048 was the number. The markets were up today, nowhere near that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When last we heard from our man in Europe, Stephen Beard, that would be yesterday, he was in Athens, giving us the street-level view of the Greek debt crisis and how people there are none too wild about new emergency budget cuts or restrictions that might come along with a rescue package from the European Union. Stephen is back today with the second part of the story, in which we hear how Europe's biggest and richest economy, Germany, isn't all that crazy about a rescue either.
I'm on Unter den Linden, the wide, elegant boulevard that runs through the centre of Berlin. This is more than 1,000 miles north of Athens and a very different world. It's very cold here today, in fact freezing, and there's not much warmth or affection for the Greeks either.
Ja, rausschmeißen aus der EG. Rausschmeißen.
Kick them out of the EU. Yes, kick them out, says this cab driver. He says, my father used to say a good gardener needs a hard heart and a sharp axe. Yes, cut the Greeks out. It's that simple. What's the problem?
Hamdi, ein Küppi muss noch, bitte.
The Einstein Coffee House, a few yards further along the road. This is a famous watering hole for politicians and commentators. Here, there's also a marked lack of sympathy for the Greeks' predicament.
When they joined the Euro Club, we thought the Greeks understood the rules and played by them. But they didn't. They fiddled the statistics. And that is something that the Germans don't like.
Analyst Heinz Schulte says most Germans are appalled that Greek governments covertly borrowed four times the limit allowed under those Euro Club rules. And they're not happy the Greeks buckled under the monetary discipline and then harped on Germany's Nazi past.
Sorry, we didn't stormtroop them into the euro. They wanted it, and they should have read the rules.
Germans say they have every reason to be furious with the Greeks and finicky about financial rules.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around.
The movie Cabaret was set in Berlin in the early 1930s during the Weimar Republic. Rampant inflation helped fuel the rise of the Nazis. That fact has been burnt into the German soul. But, say the Greeks, on the subject of the Nazis, how about paying us some more war reparations? We've already paid and paid and paid again, says Matthias Warnecker of Germany's Taxpayers Association.
German taxpayers pay the biggest share into the European budget, from which Greece is getting a lot of money. I think we have helped Greece a lot.
To the tune of around $50 billion. The Greeks claim they're not seeking financial aid from Germany, just moral support. But few doubt that if Greece comes close to default, cash will be needed to save them. OK, says Warnecker, as long as it's not our cash.
Well, it's pretty obvious that German taxpayers are not responsible for a rather careless fiscal policy in Greece.
Nevertheless, there are some analysts here who say German taxpayers may well wind up footing the bill. Put simply, they argue, Germany can't afford to stand back and watch the Greeks go bust.
You can be sure that Germany would jump in, at least with guarantees, because German banks' interests are at stake at the moment.
Ansgar Belka of the German Institute for Economic Research says German banks have lent billions to southern European countries and are very afraid.
If Greece falls, also Spain would be heavily damaged. And our banks are even more involved in Spain than in Greece.
German banks are believed to have lent more than $500 billion to other vulnerable Eurozone countries. If these economies crash, the euro could collapse. There would be turmoil in one of Germany's most important markets. If push comes to shove, says Belka, after much huffing and puffing about moral hazard, the Germans would probably pay up. In Berlin, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Amy Scott was telling us a couple of minutes ago about those new proposals for a unified nationwide education policy. Commentator Robert Reich says deciding who studies what and in what grade is well worth a conversation. But first, he says, we've got to fix a bigger problem.
The recession has ravaged state and local budgets, most of which aren't allowed to run deficits. That's meant major cuts in public schools and universities and an unfathomable future deficit in the education of our people. Across America, schools are laying off thousands of teachers. Classrooms that had contained 20 to 25 students are now crammed with 30 or more. School years have been shortened. Some school districts are moving to four-day school weeks. Community colleges are reducing their course offerings and admitting fewer students. Public universities, like the one I teach at, have raised tuitions and fees, which means many qualified students won't be attending. Last year, the nation committed $700 billion to bail out Wall Street banks, the engines of America's financial capital, because we were told we'd face economic Armageddon if we didn't. We've got our priorities backwards. Our schools are the engines of our human capital. And if we don't bail out public education, we face a bigger economic Armageddon years from now. Financial capital moves instantly around the globe to wherever it can earn the best return. Human capital, the skills and insights of our people, is the one resource that's uniquely American, on which our future's living standards uniquely depend. Starting immediately, the federal government should give states and local governments interest-free loans to make up for all school and university budget shortfalls. The loans can be repaid when the recession is over and local and state tax revenues revive. Over the long term, we've got to shift incentives away from financial capital toward human capital. A tiny 0.5% tax on all financial transactions would generate about $200 billion a year, according to the Economic Policy Institute. That might put a crimp on Wall Street bonuses, but it's enough to fund early childhood education, smaller kindergarten through grade 12 classes, and lower tuitions and fees for public higher education. The street's financial capital is important to the American economy. But over the long term, the classroom's human capital is absolutely critical.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Send us your thoughts when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. You can click on that link that says contact. And while you're there, we'd appreciate your help. Send us your stories of unemployment, how it has affected your family, if it has, or your community. Coming up, why we go green.
I mean, the side effects of it being good for the environment is great, and I'm glad, but my priority is really just my family and their health.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained less than a tenth percent today, roughly 3 points, closed at 10,567. The NASDAQ nudged up 0.75%, 18 points, 2,358 at the bell. The S&P 500 inched up almost 0.5%, 5 points, ended at 1,145. AIG-led financials higher, rising more than 10% today as investors speculated that the company could sell some more assets sometime soon. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley both hiked more than 3% as investors bet on a recovery by the banks. Wells Fargo galloped up more than 2% today. Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, and J.P. Morgan all ended more than 1% higher. I think that's the whole roster, by the by. Google pushed up nearly 3% today after it reached a publishing deal with Italy. Both Yahoo and Intel followed, chipping up more than 1%. Microsoft gained more than 0.5% today. Apple bit off a gain of more than 0.75%. Top European markets all ended more than 0.75% higher. Japan's Nikkei traded flat to slightly lower. The Shanghai Composite slid 0.75%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Thursday. Now that the ballots are counted, Iraq is expected to announce the results of Sunday's parliamentary election. President Obama will address the Export-Import Banks Conference in Washington and push his goal of doubling exports in 5 years. And it's the birthday of Rupert Murdoch. The Aussie media mogul turns 79. I'm Julia Simon.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The difficult job of rebuilding Chile after the earthquake of a couple of weeks ago is about to fall to a guy whose first day on the job is tomorrow. President-elect Sebastián Piñera takes over from Michelle Bachelet in Santiago with a set of priorities that is somewhat different now than when he was elected back in January. We have called Chilean economist Sebastián Edwards at UCLA to talk about how things have changed for the president-elect. Professor Edwards, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Mr. Piñera was elected on a growth platform, I think it's fair to say. Higher GDP growth, million jobs in the Chilean economy. How much is that going to be affected by the earthquake?
Well, there will be some effects. Certainly when you have major breakdown of infrastructure, as everyone that has seen the television coverage of the earthquake has seen, it's a problem. In particular, there's been pretty bad for ports and highways, and Chile is a very much export-oriented economy. But I'm confident that in a relatively short period of time, it will start moving forward, the economy.
You know, Chile has been for 20 years or so quite a success story economically in Latin America. But the way I read things, you know, this earthquake has showed Chileans in a slightly different light to the rest of the world. There is more poverty. There are two Chiles, as I heard the other day. How will he try to deal with that as he moves his government forward?
Well, I think that you are right, Kai, but let me say a couple of things. First, the two chiles, of course, is something that may be new to an international audience, but it has very much been at the forefront of the political discussion in Chile. So it's not news in the country. Politicians, economists, business people, and others know that that is the case. And indeed, there is going to be, I think, greater effort to try to bridge the gap between the poor and the rich. That will require significant reforms, especially in the educational area. And I think that, paradoxically maybe, the earthquake is going to probably help the new government to move in that direction.
Will it help as Mr. Piñera tries to align Chile with more developed and advanced economies than with some of the developing economies down in Latin America?
Well, it may. I mean, this is one of the points that some of us, including myself, have been trying to argue when we talk to Chilean audiences. Chile, as you may know, has been accepted into the OECD, joined that rich countries economics club. And the point that we've made is that it is high time for Chile to start changing the benchmark. For a long time, they've been very proud, and rightly so, that Chile has the best performance in Latin America. But frankly, that is not a very demanding comparison group. Yeah. So they should really start comparing themselves to the New Zealands and the Australias of the world, advanced commodity exporting countries. And they may start doing that, and that will help them move forward, I think.
Do you think the rest of the world is ready for that comparison that Chile might make?
I think that the rest of the world will look at that with some sympathy. Now, there are political problems. I mean, you cannot get out of your neighborhood. And from a political, international point of view, there is this sort of dilemma. Do they want to stay in Latin America and be the leaders of that sort of second division, if we use a sports a metaphor, or do they want to move into the Premier League ship and start competing with the advanced countries? And I think that the latter is what they ought to do. The rest of the world would look at that effort. The Latin American countries will, of course, think that they are becoming too arrogant, but success requires some degree of arrogance, I guess.
Sebastian Edwards at the Anderson School at UCLA. Professor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was great, Kai.
Take a minute for me here and think back on your day. When you woke up today, did you by any chance flip on an energy-saving light bulb? Did you put organic milk in your coffee and then wash out that mug with eco-friendly soap? If you did, how did you come to buy those products in the first place? The real reason a lot of people buy green isn't always Mother Earth, and the marketing of those products is starting to reflect that, as Andrea Gardner reports.
First, I have a confession. When I buy environmentally friendly products, it isn't for the planet. What I mean is, I buy organic apple juice because I figure it's healthier for my toddler. Energy-saving light bulbs help me save money. And I think non-toxic cleaning products are just safer. I asked around, and many of my friends admitted the same thing. Here's my yoga teacher, Ariane.
I mean, the side effects of it being good for the environment is great, and I'm glad, but my priority is really just my family and their health.
It turns out most people who buy eco-friendly products feel the same way. In a survey by market research firm GfK Roper, health and cost savings beat out the planet as the main reasons people bought green products for their homes. Companies are taking notice and starting to market those products with messages like, better for you, safer for you, cheaper for you. Jacqueline Ottman is a green marketing consultant. She says the trend mirrors the advice she's given clients for years.
Leave the planets and the daisies behind and find the direct benefits that their products can support, such as health, superior performance, good taste, saving money, or even convenience. And then the environment is a nice add-on benefit.
Sales of eco-friendly consumer products have been growing by double digits over the past 5 years, and they're expected to hit at least $300 billion this year. It's no surprise big players in consumer products like Clorox and Procter & Gamble are getting into the game, using the "What's in it for me?" message to reach more consumers. Take this ad for Clorox's green laundry soap. It shows a mom cleaning baby clothes with a child nearby.
Clothes washed in Greenworks detergent are gentle on skin and have no harsh chemical residue. And since they're from Clorox, you can trust them to remove tough stains.
It's no accident the ad features a mother. They're among the prime targets of the new push. Even green marketing pioneer Seventh Generation has created a new marketing campaign to appeal to new moms. Chuck Maniscalco is the company's CEO.
Because they're suddenly reassessing everything in their lives. There's nothing like having a toddler crawling around a floor to make you think hard about what's going on in your house.
Previously, Seventh Generation did little advertising, relying largely on word of mouth from dedicated environmentalists. But the company recently unveiled a nationwide TV ad campaign on shows geared toward women.
We want to talk to you about a revolution where no one holds their breath while they're cleaning. Seventh Generation, protecting planet home.
Maniscalco says feedback for the new campaign has been generally positive, but he admits he had concerns about alienating his most eco-conscious consumers. Marketing folks sometimes call them dark greens. Los Angeles mom Jessica Balanzia is one of them.
I think that a lot of large corporations are getting in on it, and it becomes commercialized, it becomes trivialized in a sense. But at the same time, it's like, well, if that's what we have to do in order for people to be aware of things, if we create less trash, if we create less toxins, then that's a win-win.
Jessica is a longtime Seventh Generation fan, although she says, with the economy the way it is, she's been experimenting with vinegar and a little elbow grease, and she finds it works just as well as cleanser. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, I am, as I think I've said a couple of times, an occasional Twitterer or tweeter or whatever it is. Since he left The Tonight Show, Conan O'Brien has taken to doling out his humor in 140-character doses quite a bit. He's got about 615,000 followers, but only one person that he is following. He chose, for some apparently random reason, 19-year-old Sarah Killen of Conway Township, Michigan. It's working out pretty well for her. A designer in New York is donating a wedding dress. She's getting married in September, it turns out. A guy in Florida bought her an iMac, and she's got 20,000 people following her now. Why are 20,000 people following a 19-year-old girl in Conway Township, Michigan? That is a question, I think, for another time, because we got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 3 points, less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ took on 18 points, 3/4%. The S&P 500 gained 3 points. That's about 0.25%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report. You'll get the latest in business and economic news there. And coming up next time on this broadcast, the art and the business of music for video games.
When you're writing it, you actually end up writing sort of many pieces of music that need to flow from one, you know, from the low tension to the very exciting and dramatic action and make it feel as seamless as possible.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.